This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Public lands and private profit. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Late last night, Republicans in Congress passed $50 billion in spending cuts with reluctant moderates, providing a two-vote margin. Among other provisions, a scheme to increase revenue by selling federal lands at cut-rate prices. On To the Point, we'll update the growing divide among Republicans and look at a measure that's been overshadowed by other issues. Do mining companies and local economies need federal help? Would millions of acres now held in trust for the public be turned into centers of private profit? On Reporter's Notebook later on, does Iran have a cookbook for making a nuclear bomb? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Congress passed spending cuts late last night by a two-vote margin in a bill that would also sell federal lands at cut-rate prices. On To the Point, we'll look at the growing divide among Republicans and hear a debate about public lands and private profit. On Reporter's Notebook, as Presidents Bush and Putin meet in South Korea, it's revealed that Iran has designs for making nuclear weapons. We'll get a diplomatic update. First, this news update. In a largely Kurdish town, 90 miles northeast of Baghdad today, a suicide bomber killed at least 74 people who were worshiping in a Shiite mosque. John Burns reports from Baghdad for the New York Times. John, as always, thanks very much for being with us. So, can you update the situation in this bombing case?
Well, it's very troubling because, of course, we're in the run-up now to the elections on December the 15th, barely 3 weeks away now. And Diyala province, where this happened, hard up against the Iranian border, is an area where there has been increasing trouble because it's finely balanced demographically between Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis. And the sectarian tensions that are sweeping wide areas of the country are getting worse ahead of those elections, are expressing themselves in an increasing number of attacks of this kind.
You have written about the secret underground prison run by the Iraqi police in the capital. That has been denounced by the Sunnis. Is there then a connection, do you think, between these two things?
Well, of course, we're not likely ever to know for sure, but what we know is that there has been a pattern of strike and counterstrike in this now, going back almost to the time that American troops arrived at Baghdad. So presumptively, we'd have to say, yes, there might have been. But it's, of course, beyond proof because so much here in Iraq is obscure and a matter of supposition more than it is of fact.
Can you elaborate a bit more on the sectarian tensions that you described a moment ago and what their impact might be on the election itself?
Well, of course, the hope is, and I think many of us who've lived here for these past 2 or 3 years believe that it is a very fragile hope, that there is a turning here going on by the Sunni minority community away from violence and towards participation in the political process, which in turn, of course, would mean a winding down of the insurgency and for the United States the prospect of an earlier return of American troops. But what we are seeing is an undiminished and indeed in some respects increasing tempo of sectarian attacks, which are, it's true, in some cases, Shiites on Muslims of the kind that we saw in the Interior Ministry lockup this week, where over 170, mostly Sunni Arab detainees, were abused by Shiite police officers, possibly religious militiamen wearing police uniforms in effect. But much the greater pattern in all of this has been of Sunni attacks on Shiite mosques. And the Shiites have in the main held back from responding to this, at least in the kind of terror fashion in which many of these Sunni attacks have been committed. Why? Because the Shiites see the political process as their road to the power they've been denied in the society for 350 years. By any measure, we're likely to see an increase in these sorts of attacks ahead of the election.
We're talking once again with John Burns of the New York Times in Baghdad. There has been, as I'm sure you're aware, a lot of talk in the last few days in this country about a phased withdrawal of American troops. Call came yesterday from a hawkish Democrat in the Congress for an immediate withdrawal. How is that being received in Iraq?
Well, I've been traveling with some American commanders here, and what they are telling us is that their surveys show that by a wide majority, Iraqis who say on the one hand that they would like American troops to withdraw say that, almost in the same breath, that they do not want them to go now. They want them to go when stability is achieved. And the American commanders believe that they have the President of the United States, as one of them put it to me yesterday, rock solid behind their presence here, and that they have an exit strategy without specific dates attached to it that will, in fact, allow them to make significant drawdowns over the next 2 years, beginning in 2006, as the Iraqi forces stand up. And a component of that is that the American troops intend to step down progressively and in effect, require the Iraqi troops to stand up. One American commander was telling his troops yesterday that they won't stand up until we begin to stand down. They believe, I think, the American commanders, that this is an achievable objective. But, of course, it all depends on how effective the Iraqi forces prove to be. And up until now, they have not proven to be very effective, although we are told that they are getting more so with every passing week.
20 seconds left for a question that could be too complicated for that. But can you tell us, is there any impact on the election, do you think, from these American calls for withdrawal?
Well, it will certainly encourage, of course, the insurgents to believe that all they have to do is to continue their attacks and that the American troops will eventually go home. Impact on the election? Difficult to tell. There are Sunnis running the election. There are certainly many Sunnis who would like to vote. I would suppose, yes, that it will be a factor, and that other things being equal, there's likely to be a lower Sunni turnout if the expectation takes hold here that the political ground under the American presence in the United States is beginning to crumble.
As always, John Burns in Baghdad for the New York Times. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, Warren.
In a moment, public lands and private profit on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. In a rare development since they took over Congress in 1994, Republican leaders face a split between conservatives and moderates in their own party. Yesterday, moderates in both houses scored victories, and late last night, conservative House leaders were hard-pressed to drum up a two-vote margin for $50 billion in spending cuts. Jonathan Weissman reports for The Washington Post. Jonathan, good to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
There was what would appear to be a very narrow victory for the House leaders yesterday, but they took a hit yesterday with the health and education bill, $142 billion, really a big one. With 24 Republicans opposed, it went down. What's going on?
Well, first of all, let me just say it was a narrow vote, but not a difficult one. On the budget itself, the measure to trim spending by about $50 billion over 5 years, they had the votes lined up. They just didn't want to make any more Republicans than absolutely was necessary vote for the thing, who didn't want to. These are very orchestrated events. And they, once they called that vote, they were never going to lose. This was not one of those suspenseful ones where they have to break arms and hold the vote open for an hour or two. It was going to pass. The vote on the spending bill to finance the Departments of Labor, Health and Human Services, and Education for next year, or actually it's for the current fiscal year, that was a surprise. They didn't see it coming. In fact, I think they were busy so busy trying to make sure they had the votes for the later budget vote, they just didn't see this one coming.
So they were protecting some Republicans, I gather, then, with regard to the budget, and they lost some on the other bill.
That's right.
To what extent, then, is there beginning to grow a real fissure in the Republican caucus?
The fissure was always there, but they had President Bush's popularity behind them. They had members who thought, well, I'll stick with the president because the president will be there to help me. Obviously, the president is not going to be much of a help in a lot of the districts where the swing voters live right now. The president's popularity is way down, and it's way, way down in districts with a lot of moderate voters, a lot of districts that have actually a majority of Democratic voters but a Republican member of Congress. And it is now coming into election season, and in election season, it's every man for himself, or woman in this case.
There is a lot at stake here on these bills, and various measures that don't seem to have to do with what the bill is about get stuck into them from time to time. And at stake in both houses are things that President Bush wants. One is to open the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Another one is to extend cuts in the tax rates on capital gains and dividends. What's happening to those?
Well, actually, these bills are very significant and very important. They have an entire overhaul of the welfare system. There are changes to the food stamp system, very significant changes to the Medicaid system in the House bill. Most of these were proposed in President Bush's budget, so the stakes are very high for him. And as you mentioned, there's the proposal to open the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, to oil drilling. That proposal was kind of slipped into the budget as a way to get it past the Senate with only 51 votes. Otherwise, if it was a standalone measure, it would have to get 60 votes. And they justified it by saying, well, we'll sell these licenses to the oil companies, and it will be a revenue raiser. So it got in there. It's a big problem, though, because the House members, they don't have any Democrats behind them, so it's going to be very difficult to pass the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge with Republican votes only. But in the Senate, Senators Pete Domenici from New Mexico and especially Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska don't want any final agreement not to include the Arctic National Wildlife provision. So I don't know how they work that out. And you're right, on the tax measure, the president's top priority was extending those tax cuts for the dividends and capital gains, which expire at the end of 2008. And the Senate moderates revolted, and they didn't get it.
Well, now, these bills have to go to conferences of both houses. And what happens there? Do they then debate these measures, such as ANWR, that are put in, whether you call it a revenue measure or something different from that?
Right.
And who gets to be on the conference committee, and what happens to the report of the committee when it goes back to the houses?
This is going to be a very complicated conference because these bills, they're called reconciliation bills, are actually a compilation of several bills by several different committees. In fact, it's, I think, 18 different committees or 12 different committees in all. And each of those committees in the House and the Senate side are going to have to meet to work out their piece of the puzzle, the agriculture piece or the student loans piece or the pensions piece or the Medicaid piece. And so they have to be reconciled with one another in these what they're calling sub-conferences, then put together in a final conference. It's going to be tough, and they only have a few weeks to do it when they come back in December. So it's anybody's guess. Now, obviously, as has happened for much of the last 5 years, Republicans are really going to be the only ones in these conferences. But as you said, the differences among Republicans are really beginning to surface.
Why are the Republicans the only ones in the conferences?
Congress is not run in bipartisan fashion much anymore. There are a few very scattered committees, like the Finance Committee in the Senate, that do like to include Democrats in and run in a bipartisan fashion. But with a Republican in the White House and Republicans controlling the House and the Senate, the Republican leadership have just not wanted to really include Democrats in these negotiations. They feel like they haven't had to. Now they might have to.
All right. Somewhat arcane Byzantine procedures going on Capitol Hill. We'll be watching to see what happens next. In the meantime, Jonathan Weissman with The Washington Post. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
One feature of that House budget bill that passed by 2 votes last night is a provision permitting the sale of public lands for private development. The measure would lift a ban on what's called the patenting of federal land claimed for mining under a law that's been on the books since 1872. The land could be purchased for $1,000 an acre, but critics say that it could be worth much more and that millions of acres might ultimately be involved. Congressman Jim Gibbons is a Republican from Nevada, and he wrote that provision. Congressman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Warren, it's good to be on your show, and I hope that you'll give me a chance to straighten up the record as you've just stated.
All right. If I have misstated it, you tell me what I should have said.
Well, you shouldn't have said it's private development. It is a patenting for ownership of an existing mining claim, and it does not limit it to $1,000. It's the fair market value of the land only after it's been proven that it has an economic mineral development on it and that a mine has actually been undertaken.
So those things then, this is controversial, I gather, because I have seen it written, perhaps inaccurately, that under the provision as written, you wouldn't have to prove that there necessarily were valuable minerals on the land.
Well, that's just opposite. Actually, the law is very clear. In order to file for a patent, you have to prove that you have a viable economic mineral deposit. Now, that will take hundreds of thousands of dollars in drilling and exploration and proving it, and you have to prove that to government inspectors that you have a viable mineral deposit that has economic aspects to it. In other words, you just can't have a mineral deposit that doesn't meet the standards for can it be removed and a profit made from the removal of that mineral. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do understand it, and I take it that then, relating to your previous point, the fair market value that you'd have to pay would be based then on the minerals that are under the ground?
No. The fair market value is only the surface right. Under the 1872 mining law, minerals are allowed to be removed, and what we're talking about here is the surface right above the mine itself. And for many people, when you have most modern-day mines today, they're open-pit mines where they take out huge amounts of rock and ore in order to get a small amount of mineral. It becomes economic only because of the vast size of it. But the value that we're trying to get is the surface right above the mine. What you would be talking about would be a royalty provision, much like is in coal or in oil and gas industry, which is a debate for another day and another subject.
Okay. Again, we're talking to Representative Jim Gibbons, Republican congressman from Nevada, about a proposal that's in the new budget bill. Why do we need it? You've said you wanted to correct some of the things that I said earlier. Why do we need the bill? What's good about it?
Well, what's good about it is many of the mines that we have today throughout America, most of which are in the western part of this country, have small communities that are reliant upon the economy brought in by the mine. Mines today have a lifespan. Most of them are anywhere from 10 to 20 years. At the end of that process, the mine closes, people lose jobs, communities sort of shrivel up depending upon when the mine is in existence. This will allow sustainability. For example, when a mine closes, at the end of that mine and the end of that operation, all of the infrastructure, the roads, the pipelines, power lines, buildings that were put there by the mining company have to be removed. Now, the mining land cannot be used for anything because it's the terminal end use of the land. What this will do is allow rural communities an opportunity to utilize the infrastructure, the buildings, the roads, the pipelines. Some of them even have electrical generating plants on them. And so these small rural communities that depend so heavily on this industry, which is the bedrock of our nation's economy, would have an opportunity to have a sustainable use of that land after the mine has closed. That's why we need to do that. Otherwise, they would have to remove all of that infrastructure. The communities then would lose an ability to, A, have a tax base, and, B, have access to the use of that equipment or the use of the buildings and the facilities that are there.
Jim Gibbons, once again, Republican congressman from Nevada, member of the House Resources Committee. One of the members on the other side of that committee is Tom Udall. He's a Democratic congressman representing the 3rd District of New Mexico. And Representative Udall, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. And let me first say, Warren, I think that you stated it correctly the first time. That's the way I read the law, and so I don't think there's any problem with you saying that that this is a huge giveaway or fire sale of public resources, and it couldn't stand the scrutiny. The real crime here today is that this is a stealth procedure slipped in a very large bill that couldn't stand the scrutiny of a regular hearing and process in Washington where they had to come out and say these millions of acres of lands will be sold off at fire sale prices. And so you can talk in the details as Representative Gibbons just did, but the reality is that we're giving away the public's resources at fire sale prices.
Let me just point out that giveaway and fire sale are your terms, not mine, although I did describe it somewhat differently from what Representative Gibbons said. Well, what about his point that what we're talking here about here are mines that have been exhausted in communities that need them, that this will provide a way of using the infrastructure to provide economic sustainability?
Well, the reality is that mines, because of the weak 1872 mining law, we have mines all over the West that have been closed down or in a partial closed down basis, where we're talking $10 billion, some estimates up to $32 billion of polluted mine sites where they. Because the laws are lax and because the 1872 mining law is lax, they have not cleaned these up. We have 40,000 miles of polluted streams as a result of these weak laws. And really what the supporters of this bill are trying to do is perpetuate this same existing scheme, which had been put on a ban since 1994. They want to open it up again and at fire sale prices, allow mining companies to continue to pollute, to not pay royalties, and to really not do the right thing by the environment.
So you're saying then that the situation would be very different, obviously, from what Jim Gibbons said. He also said this would not be a private a sale. Or a sale to private interests. What's your comment, Tom Udall, on that?
Well, there are several ways to purchase land under this bill, and one of them is through patenting. And the fact that he neglected to tell you was that sure you have $1,000 or fair market value, but it has nothing to do with the actual minerals below the surface. Those could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. We're talking about the fair market value of the land. And so that's why I talk about a giveaway, that's why I talk about a fire sale, and that's why this isn't good for the American taxpayer.
Tom Udall, Democrat from New Mexico. Jim Gibbons, Republican from Nevada. We'll be back and talk to both of you in a moment on Reporter's Notebook. Does Iran have a cookbook for making a nuclear bomb? On To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're not only back with To the Point. We're getting two very different views of a bill by two very different congressmen, one Republican, one Democrat, about a measure that is part of the budget bill passed by two votes last night in the Congress, now to go to a conference committee with the Senate. This has to do with lifting a ban on what's calling the patenting of federal land so that it can be sold for fair market value. Let me go back to Republican Jim Gibbons of Nevada, who authored this. You said yourself that only the surface rights will help to determine the fair market value. Representative Udall says there could be billions of dollars worth of mineral rights underneath. Why isn't that a giveaway?
Well, first of all, let me go back and correct the record that my good friend from New Mexico there has stated. First of all, I've practiced mining law for many years prior to coming to Congress. What he has stated about this being a public land giveaway is absolutely false and in some ways dishonest. In order to qualify for these procedures, you must qualify for a patent under the mining law. That means you have to prove the significant resources there, and that takes a qualified evaluation from the federal government under strict environmental laws.
But the question is, do you have to pay for them?
Well, you absolutely – today you don't pay for the minerals underneath anyway. That is qualified under the 1872 mining law, and I will agree that we need to start talking and looking at the fact that perhaps a royalty to pay the public back for these minerals should be discussed and should be looked at. What we're talking about is a separate part of the estate of land. One is the subsurface estate. The other is the surface estate. What a patent does only gives you right to the surface estate in this event, and it does not allow for a public giveaway. Quite honestly, I'm very disappointed when I hear this because I see a lot of misrepresentation, misconstruing what the law says, only to make some case that what we're doing here is giving away the American land out there, which is absolutely not the case. So for those that claim that, I would say show me where in the bill that it is a giveaway, because we have very specific prohibitions in there, very specific limitations on what you can qualify for, very specific restrictions under environmental rules, and nothing is a giveaway. This is only tied to a mining operation and nothing more. This is not going to build Toys R Us stores on every mountaintop, on every piece of public land out there. Those claims are mere hysteria.
Jim Gibbons, again, Republican congressman from Nevada. Back to Tom Udall, our Democratic congressman from New Mexico. What about
Warren,
this?
Could I give you a very specific example that
drives
the point home? In 1994, there was a company called the American Barrick Corporation that patented 1,000 acres of public land in Nevada. That land contained more than $10 billion in gold reserves, but under the 1872 mining law, it paid only $5,000 for the land and paid not a dime in royalties. To me, that is a giveaway. That's an outright giveaway. It is a fire sale of the public's resources. And I can understand a congressman that is running for governor of Nevada and having the mining industry be very powerful in Nevada, promoting this bill, but this is not a good bill for the public. This is a auctioning off of public resources at very, very low prices.
All right, Mr. Gibbons, back to you. Well, what about that specific incident? $5,000 for $10 billion worth of resources?
Well, under the current law, it's only $5 per acre. This bill changes it to $1,000 minimum or the fair market value of that surface right. That's what we're talking about.
But again, it's only the surface right. It's not the $10 billion that's
underneath.
That's
exactly. Well, you see, unfortunately, my colleague from New Mexico fails to let you know that what we're talking about is the surface rights in this bill. If you want to talk about the mineral royalties underneath the land, then we can start talking about a royalty clause. And I think every company in America, no matter who they are or what they do, would be willing to talk about a royalty for the mineral extraction. So if you want to be honest about it, talk about the surface estate. That's what we're doing here. We're not talking about the subsurface minerals. It's patently dishonest to claim that this is a giveaway based on the subsurface mineral estate, which you can mine today.
But isn't it true, though, that in the example given by Tom Udall, that you could pay $5,000 and get $10 billion worth of gold reserves and go ahead and mine it?
Well, you know what? You can mine it today without ever paying for the surface rights. You can destroy
the surface.
How do you do that? Under the 1872 mining law, it gives you claim and right to the minerals.
So the rights have already been passed on from the government, is what you're saying.
Well, under 1872 mining law, there was never established a royalty for the extraction of minerals. And that's the difference between what Mr. Udall is talking about and what we're talking about in this bill.
Mr. Udall, would you support this if, in fact, there were a royalty clause? And if so, how would you calculate it?
Well, the real point here is that this is a very old mining law that doesn't work well for the public. We had a ban on the most egregious patenting practices that were in place, and that ban was in place since 1994. And the reason Congress put the ban in is because it was going to take up reform of the 1872 mining law. What's happened now is members like Representative Gibbons, who are very close with the mining industry, are trying through this stealth procedure to slip this into a reconciliation bill so we don't have an open debate, so we don't have deliberation, so that we don't let the American public know what's happening to their resources.
Congressman Udall, you are both from Western states, Arizona and, New Mexico and Nevada, respectively. Is this something that ought to be of concern to people in other parts of the country? Representative Gibbons mentioned open pit mines that aren't good for anything anymore, excepting mining. Should people around the country be worried about this?
I believe people should be very worried about it, and we're talking about millions of acres of land around the country. It's not just in the West, but a large portion of it is in the West, and some of these lands are near national parks, near national monuments, near some of our national treasures. And so people should be outraged, and I've already heard that sportsmen and ranchers and others that are learning about this are in rebellion over it. What the Republicans hope to do here in Washington is ram it through and get it done before the public ever finds out about it.
Mr. Gibbons, the same question to you. What about this? If, in fact, many of these lands are near parks, near national monuments, in some of the national forests, should people then around the country be paying attention to what's going on?
Well, first of all, let me say that the law is very clear. What Mr. Udall intentionally failed to tell you is that the law specifically prohibits any patenting operation in a national park, in a national wilderness, in a national scenic and wild areas, in any other restricted area where it is deemed unsuitable environmentally to do this process, to go through the NEPA, National Environmental Protection Process, in a patenting process. It's the law specifically prohibits this. That's what our amendment does. That's what we're carrying on. It's certainly not represented, but there's not a million acres out there that is potentially eligible for this process. So that's another misrepresentation. Okay. Our bill changes the $5 per acre to fair market value or a minimum of $1,000 if it comes in at fair market value of less than $1,000 per acre. So we keep the strict environmental requirements. It's a very difficult process. You have to prove a great deal of economic viability to a mine before you can go out and just claim a mine and then ask to have it patented. You cannot get a patent. I will tell you as a lawyer, mining lawyer, you cannot do it easily.
Okay. Earlier, Congressman Udall used the example of somebody who paid $5,000 and got $10 billion in gold reserves. You made the distinction between the surface rights and the rights underneath. A couple of other examples that are made by Mike Dombeck, who was formerly the acting director of the Bureau of Land Management and chief of the U.S. Forest Service during the Clinton administration. He says that in
That would be the Department of Agriculture, not the U.S. Department of Land Management.
He said he was in both at one time, different ones at different times. But my point is this. He claims in the Los Angeles Times today that in 1970, a man bought public land near Phoenix for $150. 10 years later, sold it for more than $400,000 under the law of 1872. And now there's a big hotel sitting on it, the Point Hilton Hotel. He says there was another example called the Keystone Ski Resort in Colorado, which was purchased in 1983 and then sold for 4,000 times more than it was paid for. Under your provision, could those things happen again?
Well, certainly not if they're environmentally sensitive, because that's part of the NEPA process today. certainly we also restrict anybody from having or applying for a patent when it is in the national park system, if it's in the wilderness system, if it's in a wildlife preserve area, if it's in any kind of environmental hazard. You cannot, first of all, get a mine there, and secondly, it would prohibit any kind of an application for, specifically for, a patent. So no, you cannot do that under this law. Anybody that claims otherwise is just simply dishonest and claiming something that's false.
Yeah, Congressman,
these
are
old cases where patents had been issued years and years ago. This amendment attempts to correct the 1872 mining law that allowed for those things to happen. This law would prohibit it
okay.
from happening.
Congressman Udall, back to you. What then are you saying? What about all these restrictions, environmental and otherwise? You have to prove that the minerals are there. You really have to intend to mine it rather than building a ski lodge or a big hotel.
Well, that's not true. There are several ways under this provision in the reconciliation bill. One of them says that anyone can purchase public lands with mineral activity or whether there has ever been mineral activity. This is a very vague provision. In fact, three Forest Service chiefs that served under Republicans and Democrats wrote to members of the House of Representatives saying, "The changes suggested by the Resource Committee are too little understood and too potentially dramatic to be made in such a fashion. In our opinion, any such changes should be made in the standard process used for amendments to any act of Congress." And that's really my point there, Warren, is that we need to go back to really legislating and let people know what we're doing, not put in these vague phrases that can be talked about one way by Representative Givens and argued another way by me, and who knows where the courts are going to come out.
All right. Very quickly, Representative Givens, we're out of time, but are you, in fact, running for governor of Nevada? Are you hoping to have the support of the mining industry when you do it?
Well, let me tell you that, first of all, to correct what Mr. Udall has said, we have had public hearing after public hearing. This went through the complete process, vetted through the mining industry, vetted through lawyers in the legal and scholar academia on this whole process. This was not something that was crafted in the dark of night, as Mr. Udall says. It is patently untrue what he's telling you. This law certainly will improve not only the environment under which we do patenting, it'll improve the mining industry, which is so critical to everything you and every other American comes in contact with every day, including the equipment that you have on your show
okay.
that your listeners are listening
to. And are they going to support you in your run for governor?
Well, you know what? They're number two industry in my state. I'm proud that they're there. I come from a mining industry state, and I would hope that they do.
All
I
right.
have no problem with it. They're great people. They employ thousands of Nevadans at a very high salary, and they make the economy of this country work.
Representative Jim Givens, Republican from Nevada, thank you very much for being with us. Representative Tom Udall, Democrat from New Mexico, thanks to you as well. We will watch, see what happens to this provision as it moves on through the Congress. Patricia Nelson Limerick has been listening carefully to this conversation. She's a professor of history at the University of Colorado at Boulder and chair of the board of the Center on the American West. Professor, good to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
Tell us, if you will, what are we hearing here in terms of the history of the United States, going back to 1872 and Teddy Roosevelt coming in the 1890s and establishing, as a Republican, interest in preserving public lands?
Well, what an intense conversation that was. I'm glad I got to hear it. But things were pretty heated and intemperate back in Theodore Roosevelt's presidency and the after McKinley's assassination in 1901. So I guess you can't say, oh, we suddenly headed into contention. We've been in contention for quite a long time. Theodore Roosevelt and his remarkable ally, Gifford Pinchot, chief forester of the newly created Forest Service, transferred to agriculture in 1905, they are remarkably still with us. And those people, in a very interesting, very foresighted way, and a number of their important allies in Congress, created a system of public land ownership for the preceding century, the first century of the United States. The process was to get the land out of public ownership into private ownership, a system called disposal. And so that was the whole goal, was to find ways of transferring the public domain into private ownership.
And they were trying to encourage people to move west and gave them
sure.
land in order to do it.
Sure. And the concept of the of a democratic nation retaining its own domain was quite a strange and foreign one, because that's what kings do. Kings have estates, and kings keep poachers and other citizens off of those estates. So it was quite a dramatic innovation to have a democracy and a republic have permanent owned property. And that's what is so striking about the period of time 100 years ago, to see mounting concerns over a timber famine, the notion that this could have been such an extraordinarily wooded continent and we could have gone through it, that wood supply, as fast as we did. So there's some very, very solid reasons. One of the great things about being a historian is you don't have to spend your time scratching your head saying, now where did these public lands come from and why do we have them? There was a very urgent situation of depleted resources from unregulated use. So to make that decision with the creation of the Forest Service, actually before Theodore Roosevelt in 1891, and then the formalization of the Forest Service in 1905, the creation of the National Park Service in 1916, but the creation of Yellowstone in the 1870s, all that is really quite a revolution in social, political, cultural practices. And listening to these two lively congressmen debate, I think, well, no wonder we are still experiencing a lot of friction and a lot of heat on this. I wish that Congressman Gibbons, for the sake of suffering humanity, could use the word dishonesty a little less. That was troubling to me.
On the question of the issues involved, if there was a revolution of a kind 100 years ago because of depleted resources and unregulated use, is what is being proposed now by Congressman Gibbons another counter-revolution, or have we seen sort of a cyclical process? Which is it?
Well, we certainly have what seem to be cycles over the last century where the new regime of federal land management over a permanently owned public domain, friction mounts, peaks, declines, mounts, peaks, declines. We have various phases of that over the last century. I'm not sure I see it as a cycle. I think I see it more really, I don't want to get too mechanical about it, but with those new agencies and new forms of ownership, we have all kinds of challenges to figure out how to reconcile conservation with democracy and to look at the progressive era heritage we have from Roosevelt and Pinchot, which is a very expert-driven thing. The experts talk about the people and the people's interest all the time, but the experts make the decisions and let the people know what's in their interest. But we are still reckoning with how that system works out in practice. One thing that does trouble me about Congressman Gibbons' stance is that he seems to think that the creation of a law and the implementation of the law are more clearly connected. When you design a law, it takes a while to find out what it's going to be, and so his assurances about how this law is going to work in practice, as a historian, I have to say, well, we need to see what the law turns out to be.
Very quickly, in the Los Angeles Times, I mentioned earlier the op-ed piece today by Mike Dombeck, who was formerly with the Bureau of Land Management and the U.S. Forest Service. The term birthright is used. Is that what Theodore Roosevelt and Gilbert Pinchot intended, that we would all in some way have rights to these lands in perpetuity?
Yes, indeed. And again, let's remember that Theodore Roosevelt was not much on the cause of racial justice. So when he said all of us, he really was not thinking of the whole American population. But that's what it turns out to mean in practice, is that we all, it's a tremendously exciting and exhilarating concept that we hold this in common, and that we will somehow or other, as a democracy, be able to figure out how we put our recreational desires with our, I'm with Congressman Gibbons, that we depend on minerals, and exporting their production to other nations, to third world nations, is not a particularly honorable way to proceed. So it's an extraordinary experiment to have the American people own this extraordinary property and to try to find the mechanisms in Congress and stakeholder meetings and courtrooms by which we can make decisions about what we're going to do with our common property. It's not easy for condo owners to have homeowner associations and figure out how they're going to work together if they have an apartment building in Manhattan that they have divided up. So it is no wonder that we're having a heck of a time as a nation figuring out how to do it. But it's great, and it's exhilarating, and it's a lesson to the world. It's one of the ways in which the world really pays attention to us and our operations to see how we can work this out among ourselves.
Well, thank you very much for that perspective. Very interesting to speak with you, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. It was very interesting. Thanks so much for having me.
Patricia Nelson Limerick, Professor of History, University of Colorado at Boulder, Chair of the Center of the American West. In less than a week, the International Atomic Energy Agency will decide if Iran's nuclear program should be referred to the UN Security Council. Iran says its only purpose is generating electricity, but today it's reported that Iran has received received designs for weapons from the nuclear black market. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The report that Iran has designs for nuclear weapons comes as President Bush and Russia's President Putin are discussing this issue at the Asian-Pacific Summit in South Korea. Carla Ann Robbins is chief diplomatic correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We're glad to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren, how are you?
Good. Let's talk first about this report that Iran has received what's referred to in some of the accounts as a kind of cookbook for how to make nuclear weapons. Where'd they get it?
I think actually they got it from the Khan Network, but I think cookbook is a little bit too dramatic and a little bit too strong. We know that the Khan Network has sold cookbooks of this sort, and we know that Libya got a nuclear weapons design. What has come out in this IAEA report today to the Board of Governors says that Iran got what appears to me to be a few pages of documents about in 1987 from the Khan Network that begins to tell them how they can cast enriched uranium into a hemisphere for a spherical object, which could be the core of a nuclear weapon, or could be a golf ball, I suppose, but I don't think you make that out of the enriched uranium. So I don't think it's not the big smoking gun that they've been waiting for. It's not the nuclear weapons design, but it certainly could get them toward there and closer than so far anyone's been able to find inside of Iran.
Tell our listeners what the Khan Network is.
Oh, the AQ Khan Nuclear Black Market. Run by the man who helped invent the Pakistani nuclear bomb and who was under house arrest but is very, very tight with the Pakistani government. And for years, he was out there making lots of money freelancing or not freelancing, depending on how you look at it, selling nuclear technology and know-how to Libya and to Iran.
Now, in this case, it's reported, as I understand it, that these few pages, if that's all it was, were in fact not asked for or sold to the Iranians, but rather given to them in some way. What's the significance of that?
Well, I mean, that's what the Iranians are saying. I suppose if you go out and buy a box of Cracker Jacks, perhaps somebody would give you in it as well some information about how to cast highly enriched uranium into a form usable for the core of a nuclear weapon. Listen, Iran has this very long history of 20 years of concealing its nuclear efforts and its nuclear dealings with the Khan Network itself, and it's been like pulling teeth. Every time the IAEA investigators find something out, and when they found things out in Libya, it allowed them to go back to the Iranians and say, tell us more about what you got from the Khan Network. We know the Khan Network has sold a complete package. Tell us more. And it has literally been like pulling teeth out of them. And they have admitted only you know, that last year that they had this dealing, to go back to all the way back to 1987. At that point, they claimed they only had one document that taught about this dealing. But the IAEA has been quite dogged about this. And now suddenly they've come up with new documents, which I suppose they thought the dog had eaten at some point, that shows that they'd got something which they claim they didn't order, but that is, shall we say, takes them potentially a step closer to having a nuclear weapon.
All right. Again, we're talking about the International Atomic Energy Agency. Now, here's President Bush meeting with President Putin in South Korea today, and there appears to be some indication that, contrary to what we've thought before, there's an effort on the part of the Russians to move Iran's enrichment of uranium to Russia, and President Bush is saying, well, if that happens, maybe then we won't ask the IAEA to send the matter on to the Security Council. How significant a move is that?
Listen, we're in a situation now in which you know, as much and as frustrated as the U.S. is and the Europeans are with the Iranians, and the Iranians keep crossing red lines, but nobody really knows what else to do. So this is a compromise driven as much by the fact that the U.S. is quite overstretched in Iraq as anything else. What the Russians have come up and have said is that let's let the Iranians take the first step toward converting uranium. You take yellow cake, remember yellow cake?
Oh, yeah.
And you convert it into a gas. That's called uranium conversion. That was a red line up until this summer. Then the Iranians started converting uranium, and everybody decided they couldn't stop them. So now they're allowed to do that, potentially, under this compromise. But the next step, and that's the really critical one, is called uranium enrichment. And that's the one in which you shake out all the uranium that's not useful for making a bomb, and you concentrate the stuff that is, and you turn that from the gas back into a metal, either for fuel or for a nuclear weapon. And what the Russians are saying is you can convert the yellow cake, but once it turns into the gas, ship it to Russia, and we'll turn it into the fuel, send it back to you at that low enriched level. You can use it as fuel, and that way we'll ensure that you can't attempt it to make it into a weapon.
That sounds great, but apparently the Iranians at the moment are not going along.
That's true, but as Steve Hadley, the National Security Advisor to President Bush, said today, that was just the opening bit, and this is I don't want to use that term that everyone uses with the Iranians, but it is the bazaar, and that's what happens with these negotiations, so I think they're going to go back at them. Right now, you have an IAEA board meeting next week on Thanksgiving Day, not Thanksgiving in Vienna, of course, and this report today, one could say, could bolster American and European efforts if they wanted to push for a referral. I think that what we're getting and hearing from the National Security Advisor today is that they're willing to give the Russians a little bit more time before they push for this.
All right. So we will watch for that. Meantime, thank you for helping us through a very complicated situation, making it very clear. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Carla Ann Robbins, Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Producers of To the Point, Christian Bordahl, Francis Anderton, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sharon Rimbaum. Our managing producer is Karen Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family, our technical directors, Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.